Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of August. An article in the New York Times on August 16 caught our attention, titled, I Say Spend, You Say No, We're in Love. Spendthrifts and tightwads, the article went on to say, tend to marry the other, and these dichotomized duos report unhappier marriages than people with more similar attitudes towards spending. These results are from a study done by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Michigan, and Northwestern University, and they looked at several surveys that asked a married couple to assess separately their personal feelings towards spending money. Why do people seek out their opposites and spending attitudes? Most likely what we hate in ourselves, we also hate in other people. And the more we hate that quality in ourselves, the more we avoid it, according to this study. Connie Kilmark is joining us this hour to talk about the study and our attitudes toward money and how it may be really disastrous for some marriages. Connie's a financial counselor and consultant in private practice in Madison with Kilmark and Associates, and she's developed a very unique approach to personal money management. You know that. She's no stranger to Wisconsin Public Radio. She balances the emotional and psychological aspects of money with financial facts, and she's worked with thousands of clients over the years. In 75, she served as a counselor and then director of the Madison Consumer Credit Counseling Service, and she developed there the foundation of her private practice. She's been a regular guest on public radio for almost 20 years, and we're very happy to have her with us this hour. Our phone lines will get crowded, I am sure, as we talk about this. So if you know where you are with this issue and you need some help, give us a call at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. Or the email is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Connie.
Good morning.
Hello. What a treat to have you. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So would you agree with the study, or is it way off base, that we tend to gravitate toward our polar opposite when it comes to money?
Well, I thought the article was really interesting, and I would say that we don't do this consciously. We absolutely do not say what I need is somebody with whom I'm going to become incredibly annoyed in 5 years. We don't do that.
Right.
What I do think we can start with is, Plato's ancient theory that we were once all whole. Somehow we have been split, and we go through life seeking our complement or our completion. You know, there's been a lot of contemplation about the nature of attraction. And I do agree with the article and like very much the observation that the more uncomfortable you are with your own tendencies, the more attracted you will be to someone whom you think might be a corrective. As if by marrying that more organized person, the helium balloon of your optimism will be anchored with a little sandbag. And the, you know, kind of almost spreadsheet-like analytical side of you will get a little boost in pizzazz if you are attracted to and marry someone who has some style, some optimism, some, you know, whatever. And So what happens is that, of course, they're talking at the party and they're dating. And on a date, I've got to say that a spender is a terrific, fun person. And early in marriage, I think that those two people are likely to try to be nice. One of the great observations in this article is that it is thought of as crashingly unromantic to talk about the very thing that until perhaps the 17th century marriage was founded on, which was property and contractual law.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing it was founded on, and we have transformed marriage into something founded on, I think, a far less stable foundation, which is this emotional, do I like this person? Does he turn me on or does she turn me
on? I like the sentence in the article, Connie, when it said we're willing to get naked with each other, but not to ask the question about money.
It seems unromantic and calculating when, in fact, it's a far better predictor of the long-term possibilities of building a life with that person than whether, in fact, this, that, or the other sexual dimension works exquisitely. So that's both important, but this survives children and sex because it goes on right up until the nursing home and assisted living. So you better get the money thing right because it will come to haunt you right across the entire marriage.
Right.
And I'd say that the time that it's most difficult is somewhere between 5 and 15 years in, the polarization starts to set in. And just one more word, and that is that you'll notice, and I think that our listeners will recognize this, that there's a shift in language that occurs that tracks the difference in the editorial opinion of each partner towards the other. In the beginning, she's so organized. Later on, she's somewhat controlling.
Mm-hmm.
And later, she's become anal.
Mm-hmm.
He's so spirited in the beginning. Then he's sort of spontaneous. Oh, you know him. He's going to change plans at the last minute. Then he becomes impulsive and then finally downright rash. Now, these are all the same qualities we're observing. What has shifted is the way that we feel in the presence of those qualities. What attracted us starts to scare us to death.
And is it a big reason, I've read it is, Connie, for people to say, I've had it with you and get divorced?
It is, because they don't open the subject successfully. They get to a certain point in trying to be heard. They feel criticized and judged by the other, and thus they feel defensive. They don't take the conversation to resolution, and it brings out a very primitive survival dimension in each person. The more times they've gone at the discussion and have been unsuccessful, the more loath they are to open that discussion again the next time. And as a result, they delay longer and open it only when the crisis is even bigger. Thus, their chance of success in the midst of a raging forest fire of danger is even smaller, and they begin to believe that they cannot succeed. So they end up contemptuous of each other. And I will say that when I meet a couple who have gotten to the point of actual contempt, I sometimes actually have to fire them as clients because there's nothing to work with.
Oh.
There is no us in the room. If I had met that couple 10 years earlier, when there was still the possibility that they had respect for each other, at the same time they had very legitimate complaints and differences, there could have been some possibility. But it's very hard to come back from contempt.
Right. I don't even know, Connie, so this is why we have you on, of course, how in the world do you even begin a conversation about the value of money, what you think about money, how you spend money, when you're getting to know somebody? It's something that we just don't talk about.
Right. Well, we have very little in the way of guidance. Some very wise middle-aged parents will sometimes, if they know of my work or others in the country who do something a little bit like what I do, although there really wasn't 30 years ago any school to go to for this. There was just the very beginnings of paying attention to the problems that we created with credit cards and debit cards and all of the opportunities to commit future resources. It's one thing if you run out of money, you hit the wall, and then you eat oatmeal and rice casserole. But if you have credit cards and the whole notion of consumer credit, which burst on the scene in the 70s, and has only gotten more extreme as the decades have gone on, it's very easy to have the illusion that you're fine, even though you're becoming less and less fine the whole time. So I think what we have is no model for talking about this. And the possibility of deferring the consequences so long that by the time the world comes knocking at your door and says, you have no choice, you have to deal with this, it's in such an extreme situation. Moreover, we have a state that has something called the Wisconsin Uniform Marital Property Law Act. And in our state, Wisconsin, I often say to clients, you're more financially married here than you are pretty much anywhere else, because even if I don't know that you're opening credit cards, you are committing me 100% to whatever debt you create, as I can you if you are my partner. So within the context of marriage, our understanding both of the earnings and the property of the marriage, but also of the obligations of the marriage, are so commingled and so profoundly corporate that people need here especially to get this right. So when middle-aged parents send their children, sometimes the children are not sure that this is a valuable tool. But if we can make the conversation both delightful and ironic and wise, and we can make sure that there are some pointers so that each feels a degree of freedom as well as knows where to create those boundaries so that they're not feeling later on endangered by the other, I think each can maintain their identity and not feel that their survival is threatened by someone whose personal style is different.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're a master at having a delightful conversation. Do you start, as I've seen you do before, with a question about what's a word that you associate with you and money? Is mm-hmm. is that a good way to start?
Well, almost any way is a good way in, as long as you're not too afraid of the conversation. And realizing that this is one of those features in life, more like, you know, what do you like to eat? And if you can't stand the fact that I'm going to sometimes cook meat because it smells to you like, you know, a dying animal on the grill, we better know that ahead of time. Because if I'm going to give up meat for the rest of my life, I should probably think about that if I
right.
really like grilled whatever. So I think really the way to talk about it is to notice each other's habits, to notice each other's preferences, and to collect information in a somewhat neutral way at the beginning. But I don't think this is a conversation to get into at the very first date. For heaven's sakes, find out if you enjoy some of the same topics of conversation, some of the same pleasures. You know, figure out if one likes Packer tickets and the other likes the New York City Ballet, and they each want the other with them. They better solve that problem as well.
Exactly. Yeah, let's welcome phone calls for Connie. I have a feeling we'll have a lot of calls on this. I'm sure many of you saw the article, New York Times, on August 16. You can look it up now if you'd like. And it looks at an area that really could have a lot of conflict. It does have a lot of conflict on all kinds of levels, money. But in some ways, people gravitate toward their polar opposite, according to this new study, so that people who hoard money and don't like to spend it tend to be attracted to people who love to spend money, don't care very much about money. And as you can imagine, that is fraught with all kinds of dire consequences, including divorce, because it's hard to live with somebody who's your polar opposite in that particular area. It becomes, as Connie used the word, annoying, and then it can be much more than annoying. So she works with a lot of people who are in this situation. Connie is the founder of the Madison-based counseling and consulting firm Kilmark & Associates. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I like her question, what's a word that describes your relationship with money, and are you married to somebody who is the same? Did you have the discussion before you had a serious relationship with somebody? Has it been the cause of great angst and huge problems in your marriage or in your relationship? Can you change somebody who may be too much of a spendthrift, or somebody doesn't want to part with money? Can people have the influence on each other, if they care about each other and respect each other, to become more like the other person? Is that valuable? Well, let's talk about all of it. We also have an email address, which is talk@wpr.org, the number 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Connie Kilmark is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And feel free to get your end of the conversation rolling here, because once we get one call, maybe people are a little nervous about calling in about money, but I don't think that's the case. So if you want to join us, join us. I'm wondering where we learn, you know, so many people who grew up with parents who lived through the Depression, Connie, know that it had a profound influence on their whole lives, I think. And I'm wondering if that's where children learn their response to money. If you grew up in a family where there was tension, or where you had two parents who were the same or different or whatever, is that where we learn about how much we're going to spend, how much we don't spend? Where do we get all our clues about it?
Well, I think family history is a profound and important shaping influence. I think it's one of five different axes of influences in the larger scope of things. You have the intimate nuclear family and extended family. You have the peer culture. You actually have the economic moment in which a youngster comes of age, so that people coming of age right now are being shaped by the moment that we're in, this recession. You have also things as interesting as gender, birth order, and religious background in terms of sharing and responsibility for the neighbor versus philosophy of accumulation and social status. So there are quite a few axes that all are acting. Beyond that, you even have your own neurological wiring, so that individual brains respond differently to the same stimulus, to the same purchase, to the same gambling array, to the same advertising. So it would be oversimplifying to say that from the same family, all the children would come out having one experience. I often feel, when I do family history with my individual clients and couples as a way of beginning, that if I were to share the same family history questionnaire with a sibling of one of the people in the room, they would discover suddenly that they had grown up not only in different families, but in different states. And honestly, that's how differently individuals within a family experience the very same family. So that it isn't enough to say family influences. It's the response of the individual to the various ways that individual fits into that family, the role in the family drama. So it is idiosyncratic in the extreme, but it's crucial to connect that old family business so that there is no longer that sense that, you know, why am I the way I am? I must be uneducable. I think it's critical to understand that we are shaped over our entire lifespans by many factors, family being one of them. The Depression era people also, I think, came in three general flavors. Some were so terrorized by the Depression that they really honestly could not imagine life beyond loss. And so they overvalued money, and when it was gone, they couldn't face life. Then there was the thrifty people, and remember, we were doing the Depression as a community, so everyone was in the same boat, which I think helped. There was a public conversation, and as a result, it wasn't just private shame about having nothing. There was a public sense that we all have little, and there was a sense of community that I think was very redemptive to those folks. But then there were people who relished the hardship and actually cultivate the stories of their hardship. These are the ones who speak like this. When I was your age, I walked uphill to school.
Right, both 5 miles.
Ways, yep. And I ate dirt for lunch. And they right. say to us that no matter how hard our pain is, theirs was greater, and so our pain doesn't count. In other words, until you've suffered like I suffered, you haven't really earned your stripes. You have it so easy. That's not helpful. You know, what I want is their wisdom, and I would wish that anyone who's going through this time now make sure that when we speak to the children of the future who did not experience this economic moment, that we share it in a way that's wise and helpful, but not scare them and not pull a one-upsmanship. Oh, I went through the real estate burst bubble of 2008, 2009. You should never buy a house. I mean, that's not helpful.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls. Our number 800-486-8655. Cody from Oshkosh is our first caller. Hi, Cody.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good to hear from you.
Thank you. It's the first time I ever called, so.
Wow.
Anyways, I was going to say that, number one, education would help in these matters. Besides the family discussion, if our K-12 systems focused more on real-life issues that talked about economics and just general things, we'd have more meaningful conversations about these when we dated. And also, there's no rush to get married. So, date for an extended period, and I recommend living together. So then you discover all these things about each other.
I think your point about education is an interesting one, and I will tell you the only problem with it, and that is that teenagers, by definition, and this is their right in life, it's their moment in life, they feel that nothing bad will ever happen to them and that they will live forever. So while I believe that there's goodness in exposing that age group, let's call it high school, and I would say middle school, because that's where status contests begin, is pretty much by the fifth grade, you're already sorting yourself by status and by outward physical signs, backpacks, shoes, cell phones, that sort of thing. I'd like having the conversation start there, but it's critically important that we not imagine that we can do it all preventatively, because many of those folks are simply not ready to hear or listen until they have faced a real problem about a landlord or a house or a credit card, and it's at that point we have to be ready again. And then in the 30s of life, we have to be ready again. We need lots of opportunity. Moreover, getting this into a K-12 curriculum is harder than you might imagine, because every conversation about money and every curriculum has embedded in it values that will aggravate some people and please others. For instance, if I say, be careful about debt, there are credit card lenders and banks that are going to want a more optimistic message about some
sure.
financial tools. And they offer well-funded, very glossy curricula that look good on the surface, but have embedded within them messages that have an agenda about normalizing debt as if it were a personal consumer debt, as if it were the key to the good life. You see, just by looking at the advertisements that we're all faced with, how we drink in spending messages, or at least we used to. We are in a corrective moment. But we used to drink them in, hundreds to every saving message. We were getting hundreds of spending and borrowing messages, making it so normal, so normal. So I think you're right. Some good education, and then I won't touch the part about let's all live together first. I won't go to that particular point, but I do get what you're saying about really getting the texture of what is it like to be with this person.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Cody, for your call. We have lines open, 800-486-8655. I thought it was interesting, Connie, that the article used phrases like spendthrift and tightwad, because I think of laudatory phrases that you could use. Thrifty person, that's all right to be thrifty, or generous person,
right?
Because we're probably looking at some of those, and that's a totally different way to look at a person's spending habits. I like people to be generous. I think it's a wonderful thing in life.
Well, what's interesting about generous is that you can be generous or you can experience the dark side of generosity. So what if I'm saying I love treating my friends or I love giving beautiful presents? I could be generous, but if I'm doing it at the expense of my marriage because I'm using credit that we can't afford,
right,
I'll call that the dark side of generosity. And it's confusing because, after all, I'm doing it for other people. It's not for me. It seems altruistic. I've even seen within marriages where an individual buys his wife expensive jewelry. This was a couple. This is a pastiche of several couples, but it happened that these characteristics did come together in different relationships. He was worried about the fact that she was so beautiful that she would not really stay with him. He used to buy her very expensive jewelry, and he believed after a while that that's what she required of him in order to stay together. Mm. And he called me up saying, I don't know if I can stand it anymore because she requires these expensive presents. When I found my way to talking with her on the phone and brought them together, it turns out that her version was, he buys me these extraordinary presents that we can't afford, and he's hurt if I don't say I love it and I'm grateful. I wish he would stop. We can't afford this. Now, you know, where do you start with a conversation like that? Thank gosh they found their way into counseling. We got rid of a lot of things that were misunderstandings in that relationship. But there has to be a safe place where both people feel witnessed and where the conversation extends long enough, not 45 minutes. Usually these sessions are 2 hours, 2.5 hours, where we can get to a trajectory at the end of the trajectory where we've actually accomplished something.
Yeah.
So,
Mike from Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just tuned in, so I missed other things that were said, but I'd like to get the guest comments about today's very commonplace activity of marriage after living together. You know, I've had this happen with my children. They live together with their boyfriend or girlfriend for a year or two, and then expect a lavish wedding after this occurs. And this also happened recently to a friend of mine. Both of us put our children through college, paid all their expenses. Then they cohabitate and expect a wedding, you know, that costs $20,000, $30,000. What kind of message are we sending a society when this thing becomes commonplace?
Well, I hear the pain, and I also hear the clash of social mores that we're experiencing as attitudes shift about what and how and when and whether we experience each other in an intimate way. And I feel, as a 60-year-old, I do feel it's at the intersection of shifting tectonic plates of society. I personally know some friends who make their living in the wedding industry, but I must say to you that the extraordinary lengths to which the wedding industry goes and the expenses engendered by the wedding, are really quite breathtaking. And I often think to myself, if that money could be put into 401ks or a house. So that's,
right.
That's my personal opinion.
Right.
But I will say that an open conversation by parents saying, you know, this is what we value. And I would have this conversation in high school and college. This is what we value. We value giving you a beginning in life, and that is equipping you for a profession or for a way to make your living and thus to make a life. And frankly, we don't value the flowery show of an extraordinary event of a single day if you feel that way. I don't think that the framing of the conversation should begin with the announcement by the young people of their expectation. I think that parents should preventatively announce by talking with each other and then beginning to feel their way towards where their values lie, what they're willing to fund and what they're not willing to, and so the young people then can say, if we want such a lavish wedding, we will have to save for it ourselves. It isn't an entitlement.
All right, Mike?
Well, I like a follow-up. I don't particularly, you know, you said a TikTok, tectonic shift in values. That's not the question. If people want to live together, I have no problem with that. But it's the economic expectation that other parties should finance such activity. And this has just become accepted in our society. And I think it sends a message, a bad message about the value of money when this just becomes expected. This is commonplace among the college-educated. These
sure.
kids leave college with debt. Then they expect to have this lavish wedding, and it's just expected. I think people ought to start putting their foot down and saying, no, it's not going to
happen.
Well,
I agree that the parents should frame the conversation and not wait until the children announce their expectation, because I'm not quite sure that they know that they expect this until they fall in love. I'm not sure that they're thinking in the middle of their biology course, and after I'm finished with this, I'm going to expect a wedding from my father. I honestly think they come into that expectation later, and if we've preempted that conversation by setting our values clear as parents, I think we do much better by framing the conversation and saying, this is what we value and what we will fund, and this is something that we won't value. And frankly, if your life together is already started, we're starting from a different place than we would otherwise.
Yeah. And it is, in many ways, all about what we value, right? That the conversation needs to be centered on, is it important for both of us to have a home? Do we want to save for college for our children? Do we need two cars? Do we need, you know, all of that. It's what we value in life.
Well, and frankly, the message I give as I work with couples is, over and over and over again, you must work on your own retirement before and at the same time that you fund your children's education. It is very laudable and altruistic for parents to wish for their children a good education, but quite frankly, we are now in the midst of really getting it about the fact that it really does depend on us. Our own later years are our own responsibility. And if we do not put that first and feel utterly entitled to it, we are also depriving our children of an independent older age. I do not want to depend on my children for my food when I'm older, having now overspent on them when they were younger. But our children are not wise enough to know that. We have to feel clear and secure about what comes first. And then to the extent that we can help our children get a good education without, in fact, endangering the security of our older years, fine. But only if we have the ability to do that, and in that order.
Thanks very much, Mike, for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Here's an email. We have several of them, Connie. This one from Leah from Madison. The topic strikes a chord with me. My boyfriend and I have been together for 5 years, have that time long distance before he moved here. We're struggling with this issue right now. I'm responsible with my money. I was also lucky that my parents are very grounded and helped me with college. I have no debt. My boyfriend, on the other hand, has a lot capitalized of student loan debt and is still going to school and has not made very good decision when it comes to money. I sometimes feel irritated with him and like I have to be more responsible to even it out. We've discussed the future and the problems we may have because of this, but of course, there's not a resolution or a solution to our talks. Do you have any suggestions, Connie?
Well, you're already traveling towards territory that looks a little bit like the parent and the child, which I quite frankly have to say is utterly anti-erotic. If you get to the place where one of you is the grown-up and the other is the kid is going to feel criticized and want to rebel. The parent is going to get kind of gray and tight-fisted and judgmental, and it's an awful and aggravated place from which to have this conversation. The trouble is that the powerful attraction in all other departments, that attraction wants its way. Biology is biology. And so it wants its way, and it takes a huge amount of wisdom to write this movie in your minds out farther and really get clear about how this theme will come up every day, every month, every year, in taxes, in saving, in the ability to fund a vacation, in the way that a can opener can become a critical decision simply because one will, you know, go to get the most expensive can opener and the other will say the one we have works fine. I cannot emphasize enough how critical this theme is because it will recur so often. Somehow or another, resolving this in a couple with opposites like this requires getting to the place where both are valued. The one because they can take a telescope and put it on the eye for the future, and the other because some quality of life issues might get lost if it weren't for the person who can kind of be responsible for quality of life right now. But they have to respect each other. And this particular difference, given that she's the woman and he's the guy, it's going to be a little more aggravated, and it's not uncommon at all. But men seem to have the notion that they're better at this and ought to be, if I make the money, I make some money, I ought to be able to do with it as I please. There just does seem to be that additional gender theme that will come up.
Right. Can we learn to appreciate, I just don't know what you do with people who are that polar opposite. I mean, do they become more like each other? Do they have to take on some of the other's traits in order for this to work out?
They have to do that early in the relationship, because if they don't, they will polarize each other and be far more different than they started out by being if they don't get this right in the first 5 years. They've got to find a way to this conversation and be willing and vulnerable to the other's perspective and be moderated by the other. It's what attracted them to begin with, and before they freeze up and get very frightened of the other person, before they start doing secret saving and secret spending and living divided lives, they really do have to find a way to be gently moderated by the other, or at least to allow as how the other has a talent in an area that's important to life and that is beyond them, so that they celebrate what the other is good at the same time that they agree on boundaries. And boundaries of amount, up to this amount or within this area and to this extent, you're in charge of that particular part of our life. But there are limits. There's a circle around it so that I don't start to be afraid when you come home with the groceries.
Right.
I want to feel like you feed us beautifully and you make choices that we enjoy, and I can't go to the store and make those choices because I get nervous and I just want to eat beans and rice. And so I'm really glad that you bring beautiful food home to us. Thank you for taking care of that. But the saving side is equally important and has to be valued and not be seen as an endangering.
Right. Here's another email. My husband and I are struggling to get our financial life in order. I would like for Connie to talk about her approach to working with couples. I'm sure all couples are different, but if she could talk about how many sessions most couples need to meet with when you meet with them to create a solution for them.
I always start by talking on the phone to each party in a couple first. I will not see a couple, a half of a couple, because I can do so much harm by being willing to see the person who's willing to see me. Because that person then goes home and says, see, she thinks I'm right, and I've now damaged that couple even more. My most important task is to hear the voice of each partner before they have any obligation or have spent any time or money with me, to make sure that they each feel that I get a little bit of their perspective. So those calls are usually 20 minutes, maybe a half hour even, before I'm willing to even make an appointment. The first appointment is about 2.5 hours, and at the end of that appointment, they have prepared forms. They bring those forms with them. The job of that appointment is to, again, witness and hear and accurately perceive the perspective of each partner. At the end of that appointment, I send my couples away with a decision to make. I do not book another appointment at the same time as we're ending a first encounter because I'm too much of a variable in the room. So I ask that couple to think about it together and apart and decide if they want to undertake this work. I often make some rules. For instance, I will demand a moratorium on the word divorce. I will not work in an environment in which that nuclear weapon is being used on a regular basis verbally. So we stop that talk if we're really going to work on this couple's future. I will say I don't want to work one meeting at a time. I need 5 or 6 meetings with you, about 1 to 2 weeks apart. You will have homework in between the meetings. You'll need to trust me to be the grown-up in your playground, because at this point, if you could have done this for yourselves, you would have already. If you need this kind of help, and I'll often rate them sort of on a spectrum in that first meeting to sort of decide how many meetings. Some of my clients are very advanced model clients, and they are not for beginner counselors. So you want someone who is not afraid of aggravation. In other words, people sometimes are angry, and if you're afraid of anger as a counselor, you're going to duck when it starts to come up. I have the great blessing of having been born to a Sicilian mother, and believe me, Sicilians know how to fight, so it doesn't frighten me. And there's an advantage in that, because I can make it safer. I can contain that in the client context. So as they leave, they will call me back and decide what to do. And sometimes after that first meeting, people call back. Many do. I'd say 15% of people are not quite ready, and later they will call when they say, we saw you once. It felt good, but we weren't ready, and now we are ready. What I hope for couples is that we do this before we're doing it as a way of helping the divorce, because I also do that work. And the tragedy for me is that there are couples, but for having handled this issue, could have had good and fruitful marriages. So I hate like heck to see this be the issue that causes the divorce.
Yeah. Connie Kilmark is our guest. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our conversation prompted by a New York Times article, I Say Spin, You Say No, We're in Love, about research being done at the University of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Northwestern, asking a married couple to assess separately their personal feelings toward money, and they were rated on a tightwad spendthrift scale. And what was found was that opposites attract in spending attitudes, which, as Connie has suggested, can be extremely problematic, especially if you let it go for a long period of time. Connie is the founder of her own Madison-based counseling and consulting firm, Kilmark and Associates. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Mike from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Do you suppose that what you're talking about might not be a cause of a problem, but a symptom of another one? And that is that male and females are exchanging roles in the type of service society we have today. And the question I have is there a struggle that goes on after the romance cools off? And in fact, I think it always went on. Between who's going to be dominant in the household, what personality is actually going to be the guide, and the other one be, you know, in love with that person. I hope I'm clear. It's hard to express it, but it seems to me that a lot of guys now that I know have taken rather feminine roles in our society, and the women are college educated and they're making more money than the guys. So there's fellows that are staying at home. And I'm wondering, do you think that this could be a symptom rather than a cause of problems?
Well, I think you're bringing to light a different issue, and it can coexist with the one we're talking about. But I don't think that they're causal. I think that they're simultaneous. And I do think that when you say some feminine roles, you're saying roles that are necessary in the family that have traditionally been the women's roles. The market is acting in such a way that certain jobs are being better paid than certain other jobs. And that's something that is, in a sense, now that anybody can enter any field, it is creating opportunity and shifts in the way that the genders expect and respect each other. And that conversation has to happen, too, because it used to be that she needed me to bring home the bacon. And if that's not what she needs from me anymore because she can bring the bacon home, you know, what's really going on here? What is my purpose? Clearly, the woman is going to have the child. If this is a heterosexual couple and there's the expectation of children, she's going to be the one that bears the children. But not necessarily the one who nurtures them only. So I think you're at, again, an intersection of shifting expectations. And the more we can neutralize the language about whose job it is and say every family needs money, every family needs homemaking, every family needs to eat, and if you eat together, that's better. Every family needs to have the laundry done and the grass dealt with. I think if you can use more neutral language and then distribute the roles without regard to who makes more, I think you end up in a far more collaborative way of solving the equation, the algebra of making life, of making family. And you show children that everyone's contribution is important. And it isn't a matter of one gender has to do one thing or else they've lost status.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Lisa from Eau Claire. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. I wish I would have heard this conversation before my divorce. That would have been very helpful. I have a question. My husband and I, a big reason for our divorce was differing on spending in our household. And he wanted to spend quite a bit, and I kind of overcompensated for that. And now we've gone through a divorce, and it's just my children and I. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for households where there's just one parent to compensate. You know, sometimes I can be a little tight with money or I can spend too much, and I feel like not having that other person there to balance things out is sometimes difficult. And, you know, do you have any suggestions for single people who want to kind of balance out their spending?
Well, I think you're pointed to something important. You've been through a fire. You know, as a marriage ends in this kind of an issue, you're a burn victim. Each of you were. And as a result, there's sensitivity that may exceed the real and present danger of any one decision. There may be a reflexive retraction on the issue of spending simply because you were feeling so endangered for so long. I think it's valuable to have a really clear plan. You know, what's interesting to me is that when we lay out with a couple a spending plan, which they make the decisions and I help guide, if it balances, if we can get that darn thing to balance, it can be a benefit both to the overspender because it will create some boundaries and some freedom within that boundary. But it's also a wonderful challenge to the tightwad, to the person who's overcompensated in the other direction, because if you save for Christmas presents or Hanukkah gifts or for theater tickets, and you find it hard to spend for those theater tickets because it just seems like, oh, am I really allowed to do this? It just seems like it's too much fun. It must be illegitimate. But the money is sitting there, and it doesn't seem to be needed by the electric bill or the phone bill or the heat bill. You know, you're proving to yourself that the word afford is genuine. These words afford and enough and what's fair, those are trunks full of nuanced conversation. They are not simple words, and anyone who uses them as if they were superficial, self-evident words is in danger. So I think a spending plan that helps you to challenge and define what things you want to fund, following your values, and then rise to the challenge and go ahead and buy the theater tickets or buy something and see if you can live through it. Keep breathing.
Thank you, Lisa, for your call. Karen from Madison, hi. Hi, Karen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. I
wanted to contribute a solution that worked in my relationship because we were, in fact, polar opposites, mainly because our families were different and we grew up regarding money in different ways. But we were good friends for 8 years before we dated and then married. And so what we did is that we agreed to kind of evolve a corporate married life for the financial overhead of joint purchases and building a home and so forth. And we contributed equally into that account and split that 50-50 because we were both working professionals. And then the other portion of our salaries and so forth were in personal accounts. And so on occasion, there would be events or expenditures that one person wanted to spend more money on than the other. And if you couldn't, the guidelines were that if you couldn't persuade the other person the merits of the upgrade or, you know, getting the more expensive item or, you know, going to an event that the other person might have thought was overpriced, then you could finance that overhead yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You'd both contribute equally to what the baseline was, and if it mattered that much to you, then you added your own private money into the mix so that everybody won.
Hmm.
Person who said, this is my limit, I'm not going any further, and this is what I think we should do. And the other person said, yeah, but I want this color or this quality instead of the other. Everybody got what they wanted out of the deal.
Connie.
I think it's a fine solution. I often will create that so that each can have a little bit of autonomy in a marriage for differences. It really depends on trusting each other and being respectful in the conversation, so that those differences are sorted out genuinely and gently. And I think your solution depended on you being 8 years friends. And I think that's the best foundation for marriage.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Karen. One more call, about a minute left. Bernard from Oshkosh. Hi, Bernard.
Hi. What Connie has described happened precisely in my marriage. We knew each other for 3 years. We married. And then suddenly she started collecting antique cars. She bought a farm. We had 12 horses that I took care of, and by the end of it, when she moved out of state to her third job, it was $190,000 in the hole.
Ooh.
For me. She's a professional. I'm a retired professional, and I tell my friends each of my three wives took half of everything under the Wisconsin law, so I get my bread at the Salvation Army.
Connie.
It's painful.
Yeah.
It's painful, and it's this is a good way to end, saying to all of the younger people, get this right.
Right. Get this right. Connie, thanks so much for being with us.
What a pleasure.
Thanks. A pleasure to have you on the air with us. Connie Kilmark, our guest this hour. She has, as you can hear during the course of this hour, a different kind of approach. Delightful conversation approach to personal money management, a realistic approach, and an interesting one as well. She was the first a counselor and then director of the Madison Consumer Credit Counseling Service, and got the basis of her information to start her own company in 1987, Kilmark and Associates. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Jalema Noel for on-air production in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.